Welcome to the Business and Enterprise Systems Mission Success Podcast. We're here to have conversations about all the great things going on at BES. And today we've got a program we're going to be discussing, the Reliability and Maintainability Information System, or REMIS. And we've got part of the team here today. I want to introduce to you Mr. Jonathan Slider and Ms. Karen Chambers. How are you guys doing today?
Awesome. It's an amazing Thursday.
Awesome. Well, let's get into it. We've got some great information. I'm looking forward to this interview. So tell us about REMIS, the day-to-day task, the benefits for the end users, everything that it touches. In essence, what does REMIS really do?
Oh, yeah, John, thanks. That's a great question. And that was one of the questions I asked when I first came on board the team. Government PM, program manager for REMIS. I've been with the program since July of 23. And coming on board, I was like a deer in headlights. What is REMIS? I mean, it's an acronym, Reliability, Maintainability, Information System. It's a maintenance system. What is it? Well, it's an enterprise level system. And it consists of four integrated subsystems. And that's a lot of jargon to basically say we do a lot with a little. We have this thing called EIMSHRS, which is an acronym for Equipment Inventory Multiple Status and Utilization Reporting Subsystem. It is a mouthful. Essentially, it's worldwide inventory status and utilization for the Air Force. We maintain a lot of different systems, aircraft, MRAPs, ICBMs, UAVs, drones, all those different types of equipment in the Air Force. It's also made up of GCSAS, which is Generic Configuration Status Accounting Subsystem. It's essentially configuration management for different platforms. That includes B1, B2, F-15. We do actual configuration management for all equipment as well. Then we do PPS, which is Product Performance Subsystem, and that's the maintenance management and analysis data. And that allows us to make sure the on and off of the equipment maintenance, where it's at in the repair status. And then finally, CORE, C-O-R-E. It isn't an acronym, but essentially just think of like the core of your system, of what it does. And it holds our master validation tables, error corrections, file viewers, and file uploads. Karen, did I miss anything with any of those four systems or four main subsystems?
Yeah. Yep, you covered them all.
Yeah, it is a lot. And, John kind of introduced us already, but Karen is the kind of the matriarch of REMIS, and I'll let her explain that a little bit later. But so if I go to her to kind of make sure that I'm in line, that's kind of why. So in line with that question, John, REMIS is a system of record. It's an authoritative source for reportable maintenance data. It is an accountability property system of record, or an APSR. We have chief financial officer data. We are auditable, so we have to come under FIAR. EY, Ernst & Young, does audits on us every single year. If you are within the best system and have financial information, you are auditable, and you are very familiar with EY. Also, life cycle management system. We have weapon system history. It's maintained, and when it's first loaded, so think of cradle to grave. When an aircraft is brought into the Air Force or any type of equipment, it is, in a sense, in its cradle stage, and then eventually when it's terminated or retired, into the grave. We interface with 38 different systems. That's either inbound, outbound, both and, file upload, file viewer, and so on and so forth. And then as far in regards to what we do within BESS, the big thing is with an 8.4 portfolio, we were the first system to implement the ICAM, which is Identity Credential Access Management solution for SAFMG to be able to monitorize how users access our system. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, I believe so. And then annually, we reduce our security vulnerabilities by 85% by using that. So that's kind of a little bit about REMIS in a nutshell. There's definitely a lot more we could talk about it, but for the sake of time, that's kind of your overview.
REMIS has this long history. Tell us about the background, the various iterations. How long or how much has REMIS evolved over the years?
So great question. REMIS has evolved quite a bit over the last 35 plus years. So the first contract was awarded back in 1986, And then functionality went live for two of the systems that Jonathan talked about, the iMSures, which is the inventory and possession status and utilization, and then PPS, which is the on equipment, off equipment maintenance tracking. So that went live in 1992. Then along the way, you know, we brought in GCSAS, which is the configuration management of things. So Remus started out on a mainframe, on a tandem mainframe, big old box. And in about 2004, it got monitorized and got moved to a Linux and then onto a Linux. And so the Air Force hired a third-party company called TSRI, and actually TSRI has a book out that you can find on Amazon or any bookstore, and it talks about the modernization of Remus that took place and that they collaborated with the Air Force. So what they did is they took a lot of our code, and we, the Air Force worked with them. We came up with a methodology on how to convert the code. Some was converted manually, so the front end screens, but the back end was mostly done by this third party TSRI. And they took our COBOL, JOBOL code, so pretty old language, and bumped us up into JSPs and to Java. And so that was a huge, you know, step forward with that. And then in 2018, we actually moved all of our environments to DISA. So we have our production there and our test environments, et cetera, down there. Up until 2022, the January of 2022, this program has ran as waterfall. And so in January of 2022, this program started running as agile. So, you know, transformation from waterfall to agile can be a little stressful, a change, a mindset change for people. But that went very smoothly. It took us some time. We ran into some little bumps along the way, but actually, we got Remus got their agile maturity assessment, and we went from infancy to run pretty quickly in about 2.5-3 years. So we've made a lot of progress. With that, moving along from going from waterfall to agile, we were able to increase our software cadence to approximately every 6 to 8 weeks. So depending on, you know, holidays and if it's a COTS upgrade, and we depend on DISA being involved or not. So we used to have about 3 to 4 releases a year, and we're hitting almost 10, sometimes, you know, more than that in a fiscal year. So
wow,
increased a lot of productivity to get the changes out to the warfighter as quick as possible.
You talk about getting the updates out, but tell us about these end users. Who are the end users? Where are they? How many? What are they doing?
Yeah. So before we go into that, I do want to also bring it to attention about the agile, because okay, I think it's important when you think about speed, right? Agile, yeah, agility. So we actually have our sprints or 3-week sprints, and that's every project that we do. We have amazing scrum masters that lead those teams and are able to do the work, break it down into 3-week sprints, allowing us to provide, you know, code releases or projects such as ICAM, VC25, NC3, a lot of other ones that are kind of down the road that we're going to be addressing. So all that to say, you know, as I've seen Remus modernize in the last several, you know, months, just to be able to kind of see it in the lens that Karen's been able to share is pretty impressive. But yeah, speaking of our users, our customers, the ones that we work for, half for A4LM, that's our functional leadership, SAF FM, our financial managers. Because we are a financial feeder system with our CFO data, we want to make sure that we're reporting properly as we're accounting for all the property, all the equipment that is entrusted to us to track. And then AFMC or A4N, they are our customers. As far as our users, we have about approximately 1,500 that interact with our system regularly, but over 75,000 that Remus touches. And that's pretty impressive when you think about it from the Air Force standpoint, whether it's a military member or it's a contractor or government civilian, you'd be able to interact with our system the way it is. As far as the types of users, worldwide users / stakeholders, Congress, yeah, Department of Defense, Air Force, Navy, DFAS, where we all kind of get our money from, or we make sure they're checking it. SAF, Secretary of the Air Force, HAF, Headquarters of the Air Force, MAGCOMS, Guard and Reserve. I might keep going and going and going, but essentially our users are worldwide. They're not just here in CONUS. And so it's just really interesting as I got to learn more about the system and what it does, its capability, its scope. And it's really a powerful tool that all of our users benefit from. And as Karen mentioned, we are releasing regularly our updates. And those include different things such as tech refreshes or addressing tech debt, which is a big thing BESS right now, is making sure that these systems that are software based are making sure that their tech debt is, we're limiting our vulnerabilities.
Right.
You know, we do a lot of different things or special projects, or once again, ICAM, this compliance mandate that came by to make sure that we're addressing these vulnerabilities that, that have been assessed through audits.
Gotcha. Now I love what Ms. Chambers, what you were talking about a while ago with the different languages and methodologies and the evolution. But in that, with the end users, how are you guys working with these releases, updates, to improve their experience? What's going on with that? What does it look like on their end?
So, Karen, I think you and I can tag team this just because of where the user satisfaction came from. I know and I'm aware that there was a survey done through our Remus users in 2021. And we're just kind of asking them, what would you like to see? What would you like for Remus to be able to do, whether it's capability, interface? And so, you know, you think about I remember when the internet came out, right? I was in high school and everything was just dial up and slow and all this kind of stuff. But user interface wasn't something that people really thought about. You know, now you go to websites and, you know, all the different bells and whistles and what they can do and parallax. And when you speak of like web design, visual design, Remus and Karen can definitely speak to this from the standpoint of the visual aesthetic of it. And as much as we might say that might be not that big a deal, it really is to the user from functionality standpoint, how you navigate through screens, because you want your information, you need to load or you need to get information from the system. How are you interacting with it, right? And so that was one of the big things was Remus had a redesign of our menu structure. Once again, you hit a button at the top and then the waterfall, and then the waterfall, and then the waterfall. And that's hard to navigate, because then if you slip with your hand, you know, now the menu goes away. And how are you really going to be able to do something for the users to really save them time? It's an efficiency issue, but it's also just an experience issue, which I think, in my personal opinion, is underrated when it comes to something as simple as working with a maintenance system. Karen, I'll kind of turn it over to you. If any more thoughts about that, or definitely add more to the user satisfaction question.
Yeah. So we really took like I said, we got lots of feedback from the users about, you know, the user experience, about using the screens and how they were usable and our navigation of getting to the screens. And so that was all redesigned. We got lots of kudos back from the end users. We made it much more simpler. The way we grouped it is, you know, instead of having everything, like Jonathan said, you know, you go to this menu and then it pops open another menu and then it pops open another. You know, and if you slip your hand, then you got to start all over again. So now the way that it's structured, it's very straightforward for the users to get to, very straightforward to see everything that they want to see at once, very straightforward for them to be able to add their own little menu with their favorite screens that they use all the time when they come to Remus. So they don't have to go find them. It's just right at their fingertips.
Right.
Very easily to get to the help files now to look at if they have a question about how to fill out a screen. You know, we made that more simple to get to. So that was a big thing. We still have some more to do, but that was phase one, and we got lots of great feedback. And we worked with the end users on that and showed them, you know, worked with them and got their feedback, because they're the ones that are using it every day. So, you know, to make it more usable for them was, you know, our priority. Another thing that we got feedback on was training. They wanted some, you know, computer-based training that they could use, go get and use for different areas, the subsystems in Remus. And so we created some packages like that to put out for the end users, and also launched an Ask Me Anything. So we started off monthly with that, and I think we've gone quarterly now. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jonathan, but where all the Remus users, you know, there's a time and a place, and we have a channel that was a DoD channel that was dedicated to them, that they can ask questions anytime they want and get feedback on the fly, you know, that they didn't have to send an email or open up a ticket and wait for a reply, that they could easily, you know, be more one-on-one active, you know, answering people's questions. And so that has been really great. The users have really appreciated that too, that they've just, you know, can go type in a question in this channel and then someone will address it and, you know, get back with them. Either they'll say, hey, can I give you a call so we can go over those details? So getting more information in a lot faster method.
Wow. So go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to add to the training modules and Ask Me Anything. So I've seen it firsthand. You can actually find our Remus 101 or a lot of our trainings on My Learning. And so that's really cool that we've integrated with other systems to be able to offer that, especially with the development of ICAM, which I keep hinting at it and alluding to it. You know, a user gets trained in a way to do things and interact with the system. And so they build up these habits. And so when we have to change things or change methods or processes, how do you address the user? And so the Ask Me Anything actually was a huge proponent for that. It allowed us to really be able to hear their thoughts. And we had some pretty positive feedback specifically with the implementation of ICAM. But the training modules, we have a fantastic group of subject matter experts that work on in the PMO, the project program management office, that have developed these. And they do screen captures, they do videos. It's not just a stagnant PDF that we hand out and you know, either use it to fall asleep or you use it to get informed, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, training is huge. And this question alone, the answers that we provided is just showing that we are very responsive to our users. We want to them to be communicative and be able to trust that we're going to reply to them and answer with their needs. So I'm super thrilled to be able to experience it firsthand.
Yeah. And you said it perfectly earlier. This is not just about aesthetics. It's about productivity. So what you guys are doing is just streamlining everything for every end user. Incredible work there. I know you guys recently launched SailPoint. Tell us about this. What is it? How does it impact the mission, the work of Remus?
Yeah, so SailPoint is the software. ICAM is the effort. It comes from a 2022 Air Force audit that was done, and it discovered or identified 192 notice of findings and recommendations, or no-nos, as I call them. And if anything, it's to do with vulnerabilities from a security standpoint. And so being a financial feeder system, 69 of were identified through this audit to have these NFRs. And what it does is allows the user to go from the traditional 2875, DD-2875, which is essentially a user access request form. It used to be a paper form, then everything went digital, and then it's a PDF. And so using an the real life scenario of myself, when I came onto Remus, I needed access to Remus because I wanted to look at it. I wanted to know what I was doing. So I was sent by one of the program managers the 2875. I had to put my information in. I had to fill out all the different blocks. There's several blocks, I think 18 specific blocks, to include your name, email, all these things. And then you have to justify, why are you asking for a specific access? And it's not just Remus as a whole, it's specific modules or application, or I don't want to say applications, but certain elements of Remus. And then you have to sign it. Then you have to send it to your supervisor. Then your supervisor has to make sure everything's there, everything's correct, all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed. And then from there, they have to send it to the security manager. And then the security manager has to send it back. And then there's a couple other steps involved just so before you can even get access to it. So let's say good case or perfect world scenario, everyone's in the office that day. Everyone has their email and they're able to get access. Then yes, you might be able to get access that very day. But the reality of the world we live in, people have meetings, or their people are out on leave, or they're TDY or whatever it is. And so you're not always guaranteed to get access immediately as soon as you need to get it. And so what SailPoint allows us is it converts that DD-2875 to more of an actual like electronic $28.75, where you get access to SailPoint. You look for the entitlement that you need to whatever you're going to do, whether you're a configuration manager or a pod manager or whatever you are. Yeah. And then you can access, you're going to put your supervisor, security manager, and it's going to go off and it's going to shoot it off instantly. And it's going to do all that other stuff because it's bouncing it against your portal ID. It's going to bounce it against databases. It's going to make sure that you have the authority to do it and permission to do it. Yeah. And so we were one of the first, as I mentioned, first best systems in A4 portfolio. We were the first A4 portfolio system to onboard to ICAM, SailPoint ICAM. And that was a huge success. I'm pretty proud of it. That was the project that I managed personally. And just had a fantastic team with, you know, Karen's team at IMC, and then, you know, working with the SailPoint team, the Deloitte team that managed the SailPoint. So what this actually has allowed us to do, it's reduced security vulnerabilities by 85%. As I mentioned, it's the man hours, it's streamlined user access, saving hundreds and hundreds of man hours. And then finally, it positions the organization to meet future cybersecurity requirements and regulatory standards. Because that's what it's about, right? We talk about agile, you know, not just the actual process or ideology of how we're doing software development, but we need to be agile, especially with the great power competition going on right now.
Yeah.
Being able to respond to our threats, internal or external, and this allows us to do it. So we onboarded, did it, learned a lot from it. A lot of people are coming to us to ask questions about it. So we're really proud of the effort that we did to get it into place.
And see, this is,
and this does,
go ahead.
And it helps with also, you know, you're not emailing a form around, right?
To
different people to try to get them to sign it. And then, you know, maybe that email got lost or that person's, you know, went TDY for, you know, 3 weeks. So it's really streamlined to get people to be able to get their access to whatever system that they're asking for.
And this is what is just so fascinating to me. You guys are really doing some great things. You're talking about efficiency and dealing with vulnerabilities and productivity and all of this stuff that's just so modernized with great speed. And then we talk about this. It's the program that started in the what'd you say, 1986?
Yes.
So what are some of the say that again?
That was the award. Yep. We went live 92. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what are some of the challenges you guys have faced or continue to face as you modernize a legacy system, whether it be at the program level or really especially with people?
Great. There is lots of challenges that come along when you want to try to modernize things. You know, change, people don't like change. So when Right. you do, you know, modernize your screens, change the way the screen looks, feels, you know, people are like, well, I used to go to this field and do this, and then I used to press this, and then I did this. And then when that whole, you know, ABC doesn't flow right anymore, then they get, you know, people get, oh no, I don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, because people don't like change. They like to do, this is the way I've always done it. So that's why when we do modernization, you know, it's really important to involve the users in from the beginning.
Yeah.
Show them as you're going along. Get input from them. Hey, would this help you? Would this help you enter this data in? You know, if we could populate some of the data for you where you would just have to click a button and the screen would populate 95% of the fields, and then you would only have to enter in what's necessary.
Yeah.
So that's really important into getting them involved early. If they're involved early, they're more willing and happier about the change, right? Because they feel like it's their product. It's not just you did it and you're saying you're stuck with this, you got to use the screen this way.
Right.
So that really helps for one thing. Some of the and training, you know, so before you go live, make sure that, you know, because maybe you didn't get to interact with every user, wasn't involved in the prototyping. You know, a lot of people are busy. We all have lots of work to do. But before you go live again, make sure you take the time, create a training cycle, packages that you can get out to people way in advance before you go live. So they have the ability to play around with it, ask questions. So then when it does go live, that their day-to-day tasking is not affected from them getting their job done. Some of the things is, you know, when you change technologies, you know, you got to train your staff too, right? Who's developing the system. So making sure they're trained and they understand the nuances of this new technology that you're using, and make sure they understand all the vulnerabilities that we don't fall into, and that we're, you know, STIG compliant and we're compliant with everything. So that's one of the challenges, as well as sometimes you have to, when you're changing over, you know, especially when you're changing languages, you know, back in the day when we went from COBOL to JOBOL to Java, you know, you have to freeze your code, right? You can't be making changes to the code at the same time that you're, you know, changing it. So sometimes, you know, there's a period of time you have to go into a freeze mode, which does affect getting functionality out to the end user. So it's all of that you have to balance, and you have to look at, you know, what can we do? Can we break it down? Can we do small chunks at a time so we don't affect the end users, you know, as minimal, try to minimize that as much as possible.
And I'll jump on to that, because coming from the program management office side, when you're tasked with, in a sense, where we're at, we're in a sustainability or capability support phase of the software acquisition pathway. And what people would say, oh, you just have to keep the lights on. And that's not true at all. And Karen can attest to that, because we're getting requests from customers and wanting either new interfaces. There may be something on their end changed, and so now we need to change code or update code on our side. And as much as people think, oh, it's just code, no, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's old code, and from us as a program office, when we're working with Karen and her team, it's making sure we're talking to the right people that understand the process or what we're going to do, and they can communicate to us to say, hey, you know, I don't want to say the intelligent ones, but the technical ones, the more trained ones, the ones that are more knowledgeable of the system. And they can say, well, you're a customer that you're saying brought something to you wants this. We not necessarily can provide that. And so from us as the program management office, getting our taking a step back and saying, no, we're not just in a sustainability and capability support phase. Like, we are constantly growing, constantly changing. You know, as Karen mentioned, going from a waterfall to an agile, you know, releasing, I think our LCSP, I just read recently, our one that we did about 5 years ago says 3 to 4 a year. We're doing 10 to 12 releases a year now. And that's just to accommodate changes in technology, changes in security, working with security or cyber folks, working with engineer, working with finance. I mean, there's so many moving pieces to it. As much as it's, oh, it's software. No, it's not just software. There's a lot going on. And it's just been really cool to see the team being able to be very agile and be very flexible when it comes to responding to requests. So like I said, Karen's team is just doing a fantastic job as we continue to navigate all the changing landscape.
And as, you know, even the Air Force, you know, where the DOD goes along and looks at their processes and procedures, you know, which everyone should be evaluating those, you know, at least, you know, annually, twice every 6 months would be great. You see different ways, like, well, why are we doing this, you know, or, oh, we've got this data, or we can analyze this differently and get better results so we know how to order parts that maybe are failing on these aircrafts. So as things change, business rules change, right? They update the TOs, the AFIs, which those things that are documented in the AFI and TOs, those business rules go into the maintenance systems, right, to ensure that end users are following the AFI and TO. So as those rules change, you know, then code has to change to accommodate that. And, you know, that's never something that's going to stop, right? Because as we go on in life, we're constantly looking for better ways for us to do things, right? Make it better for our end users, or make it better for, you know, our pilots who fly to make their aircraft safer.
And you just said the magic word, better. If your teams, if your users are embracing the change, people embrace change when it's better, when it's easy to embrace and easy to adapt to. So clearly you guys are doing, you have the special sauce that's working. So I want to move into this. This is probably the question I've been most excited about. Tell us about some of the projects with Remus, BC25 and NC3.
Yeah, so Karen's going to take the bulk of this answer, but just for the viewers that are engaged and were kind of like, hey, tell me more. So it's easy for you to say, oh, Remus can do this or can do that. Like I mentioned previously, like a customer comes to us and they said they want an interface or they want code changes or they want this, that, or the other. You know, VC25 and NC3 were part of our big six. There was a prioritization when it comes from requirements. ICAM fell into that. That was kind of one of those things that we had to be very flexible when it comes to our work effort and our workload. And so ICAM was not on our radar. It came out of nowhere. And so we had to rearrange some things. And it's kind of tied closely to that that user survey that we mentioned earlier. And you know, we were addressing it and we had a Scrum team working and accommodating those users' requests from the survey. But once this ICAM effort came on board, we had to quickly adjust and say, okay, who's going to do what? Where, what are we going to do? How are we going to prioritize? But the two other big efforts that a customer did come to us, or two customers specifically did come to us through the normal channels, the traditional channels, they brought funding and they brought requirements. And it was Karen's team that worked through, you know, tech approach or tech evals, rough order of magnitudes to be able to, let's see how we can address this, how we can solve this and work this through. So that's kind of setting up Karen to be able to kind of go into a little bit more. You know, we are a CUI system. And so Karen can kind of share a little bit more with what we can share. We're not going to be giving any type of information that you can't find on Google. But it is something that that Karen's team has been able to really attack with these two efforts.
All right. So for NC3.
So I'll let Karen go ahead.
Yeah. All right. So if for NC3 assets, those assets were, you know, they're assets the Air Force owns today, but they were being tracked as type equipment A, as aircraft. And so, as I had mentioned of the AFIs and the TOs, there are certain business rules that apply to like a piece of support equipment or a piece of comm equipment or an aircraft or a missile. And so the NC3 people, were tracking some of their assets in Remus as aircraft. And they're like, we really want to track them on our own books, right? We don't want them to be rolled up all underneath type equipment A aircraft. We want to have our own. And so they asked that Remus be able to support a new type equipment N, and they would, for the most part, use the Air Force business rules, but they had a few differences, you know, that they wanted. And so that was what we needed to do, is we needed to make, you know, be able to support a new type of equipment. So when you're doing validations and you're saying, oh, this particular field can only be 1, 2, and 3 when type equipment's A, but it can be 4, 5, and 6 when you're talking about a piece of support equipment. So we needed to modify our code to support type equipment N. And you know, they want to do the same as aircraft. They want to do configuration maintenance, maintenance documentation, status and utilization, you know, all the same types of things, but with a little nuance with them, you know, things are a little bit different, you know, everybody has a little bit different roles, right? So that's, we are almost through that, capability. We've got probably about, 9-10 months left to go on that. And our counterpart, base level system, IMDS, is also making some changes to support that. And so hopefully we'll have that capability activated and ready to go live at the first quarter of FY25. And then VC25. So a couple different things about VC25. Today, different aircraft are tracked. They use different type of tracking. And so work unit code is one type, and LCN is another type. And so like F-22s or CV-22s, they track stuff by LCNs. B-1s, B-2s, they track things by work unit code. Well, the commercial world uses ATA codes, so Air Transport Association codes.
Right.
And so the Air Force kind of wants to start aligning with the new fighter jets. They want to start using the same type of concept that the commercial world uses. And so Remus had to support, add capability to support that. And they have their own business rules, you know?
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. When you're, you know, you have a car and you have to get your oil changed every 5,000 miles, right? And so you take it in, they, you know, first 5,000, you take it in, you get your oil changed, right? And then they give that little sticker on your car and they say, okay, come back in 10,000 miles, you're going to need your oil changed. So you're watching to see, you know, when to get 10,000 miles to make sure you get in there. So that's, you know, there are different business rules for that, but that's kind of how where WOCs and LCNs and ATA codes comes in. You know, when do my oil need to be changed? When do I need to go, you know, change my tires? You know, when do I need to change my brakes or my brake pads and stuff like that? So again, they have their own sets of business rules that are be documented in the TOs and AFIs. So those are new business rules that we had to code for. The first, and that's going to apply, the first one that's going to use that is the VC25B. And that isn't scheduled to, the first one isn't scheduled to be delivered to the Air Force till around FY 2028, 2029. Okay. So we got a ways to go, but we're ready to go with that once they are. Of course, there's other interfacing part or systems, maintenance systems that need to support that functionality too. So until they're all ready to go, we won't be able to turn that functionality on.
Gotcha.
Then the second part of VC25 is the White House Military Office and the Presidential Airlift Group. They wanted their data to be restricted where not everyone could see their data. And so we needed to make some code changes so that they're going to say who has access to that data and who can look at it and see it. And so then we had to make some changes to that. Depending the user that you are, then when you go to run a report for, you know, how many hours are on, you know, these types of aircraft, that if you don't have that permissions, that you wouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
So that we're really excited about, where that's functionality is going to be able to be delivered. We'll be working with, like I said, the White House Military Office, as well as a Presidential Air Lift Group, working on a schedule, but that will be the second quarter of FY25. And so the thing about that, both of those initiatives, is anyone, it couldn't just be the VC-25, right? It could be, you know, the F-22 could decide to use this functionality. So it wasn't just designed around the VC-25. We did it so it would work across the board. You know, for anybody, you know, if F-35 comes down, they want to play it. The, you know, B-21s, if they want to. So we're really excited about that, to be able to get that implemented for the for those users. Because we do have some VC-25 data in today that they could start using that functionality on.
Incredible. You guys are busy, huh?
It's not a dull moment on this program. It's very exciting. Believe it or not, it's a great program to work for.
That's awesome. And you've also reminded me, I need to get my oil changed. So I appreciate the reminder. I really appreciate the synergy between you guys as well. There's clearly a lot of respect for what your teams are doing and a lot of mutual respect there. So I just want to say thank you for being our guest today and giving us just so much information. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around a lot of what was said, but luckily I'll get to watch this many, many times. So thank you guys for being here today, Ms. Chambers, Mr. Slider, and for all of you, thank you for tuning in to the BES Mission Success Podcast. At BES, we run the systems that run the Department of the Air Force, moving money, manpower, and materiel. Until next time, good day.